Welcome back to the Mel Kay Show. You may know my guest today, tell you a little bit about himself, but I've been watching him for quite some time. He knows a lot about what is going on in this country, not just about January 6th, but about the entire justice system as it stands right now. Thank you for joining me, Bill Shipley.
Mel, how are you doing? Nice to
I'm
see you.
I'm doing good. I'm doing good, and I could think of nobody I wanted to start off 2024 in that understands the legal system better than you. So thank you for joining me today. A lot is going on. How are you doing?
Doing fine. I'm here in D.C. getting ready to go over to the Capitol to watch the congressional screening of the new Epoch Times documentary on January 6th, hosted by Joe Hanneman.
Great. And this is the Real Timeline documentary? Is that the one?
I don't think that's exactly it. I forget what the name of the... there are two or three of them all came out sort of at the same time.
Right.
And I don't think this is Real Timeline. I watched part of Real Timeline and was favorably impressed with sort of the lack of editorializing and sticking to the sequence of events in various locations. That's something that I have emphasized recently in discussions that I've had with a variety of interested parties, is that, you know, the video that was made available to the public over a long period of time, the limited video that was made available to the public as compared to what defense lawyers had access to.
Right.
And as was propagandized and inaccurately described by the J6 committee, the events of the day were episodic. You know, if you didn't know any better, based upon what you were allowed to see as the public, you would think that the violence was just continuous and nonstop over a period of 2.5 or 3 hours, starting at about 1 o'clock, when in fact, that's not true. There were episodes of violence in specific locations at specific times, but there were long periods in between those episodes of violence where there wasn't a lot going on.
Right. Right. Yeah, I had on Steve Baker, who you know, and he was saying like this 40,000 hours of footage, a lot of that is there's nothing on that footage. It's just like it's all these different cameras over a 24-hour period. He said there's a 6-hour period that he himself thought was really crucial. Now, for the audience that might not know you, that would be a surprise. Can you tell my audience a little bit about your background and why at this point you are on the front lines in this entire DOJ? I don't know what to call it at this point, January 6th debacle.
Well, as you know, on Twitter, I have the username Shipwrecked Crew. So that's become pretty widely known in the J6 community through my actions on Twitter and my comments. And that username goes back 30 years, believe it or not. That was actually the very first email account name I ever had way back on America Online, AOL. So that's the origin of that. It's just something that I started back in probably the 90s and just have carried it forward, you know, through, you know, one social, you know, email or social media.
Right.
Now, for the last 26 months, 2 years and 2 months, I have been counsel of record in dozens of January 6th cases. I think the last time I looked a couple of weeks ago, I have 20 or 21 clients whose cases are already resolved. And I have another 22 clients with pending cases now. So I have done, you know, more than 40 January 6th cases. I have watched hundreds of hours of video. And I'd say thousands, but you know, as you just pointed out, there's a lot of the video among the 44,000 hours that is nothing.
Right.
Because what a lot of people don't understand is here's the math. Remember that we always had the issue of the 14,000 hours of video. For months and months and months, it was 14,000 hours of video. Well, that was, you take all of the closed circuit TV cameras, you know, you can count them.
Yeah.
You take all of the body worn cameras, you can count those, and you multiply them by noon to 6 p.m. That's what the government, you know, the events began to happen at the Capitol, according to the government, you know, shortly after noon. And by 6 o'clock, the crowd was pretty much completely removed from the grounds. So if you take those 6 hours times the number of cameras, it's roughly 14,000. So that's where the government was producing 14,000 hours worth of video. 44,000 hours is simply the same number of cameras over 24 hours. Essentially, the demand was made, and the new administration, first under Speaker McCarthy, now under Speaker Johnson, agreed to make all the CCTV and body-worn camera footage available between midnight on the morning of January 6th and midnight on the morning of January 7th. Right. And you know, there's thousands of hours there where you're just looking at a camera with a screen showing nothing. You know, it's showing an empty hallway for hours at a time inside the Capitol building.
Right.
So now some things have been discovered by Steve Baker and others.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if you know this. I put it online. It's been out on Twitter, but Steve Baker is my client.
Yes, I do know that. He came on recently. Yeah, I do know that. And I love Steve Baker. And he found that those he caught those cops lying about where they were and what they were doing.
That is something that I am actively looking at right now, because the transcripts of that testimony, the official transcripts of those days of testimony, has now come through as we prepare to begin looking at filing briefs and the appeals on behalf of the various Oath Keeper defendants who were convicted. That testimony by Lazarus and Dunn came out in the first Oath Keeper trial, not so much in the second or third trial, but in the first Oath Keeper trial. And so we're going to look closely at what Lazarus and Dunn both testified to and what's shown on those videos. And we have Harry Dunn's book, what he said in the book. And, you know, Steve Baker's reporting here has been pretty careful to point out exactly why their stories are not consistent with what's shown in the videos. And it's only from the video that was produced well after trial that this has become clear. Yeah. Now, you know, I've not examined it with the granularity that Steve has examined it yet. And I have discussed it a few times, and I'm actively looking at it now. But I expect this is something that is going to become more of a point of emphasis by defense lawyers in the weeks ahead as we move into the appellate stage of the Oath Keeper case.
Yeah. Now you've been in this from the beginning, and what I've seen, I actually talked to Jacob Chansley, who's one of your clients as well, in Arizona, who had great things to say about you. But a lot of these people in the beginning, they were given public defenders. Many of them were offered plea deals right away and took them just for whatever reason. There's multiple reasons somebody would take a plea deal, including not wanting your life to be put on hold, whatever. But now we're at a place where so much information has come out since the beginning, since you first got involved, that is leading to a lot of questions about the earlier cases, about the veracity of what was being said, not just with the two cops, but many other things have come out since then. So where are we with the people that you've already represented that either already served time or made a plea deal or anything? How now, can any of those people, if anything is proven to be not true from their case, can anything happen now, or are the things that are already adjudicated done?
Well, the federal system, as far as entering guilty pleas, is pretty strict in terms of how the guilty pleas get entered. It is a significant process. It is a hearing that can take anywhere from, 25 minutes to an hour, depending on how each individual judge sort of approaches it. And part of that hearing involves both in writing and, in fact, let me point this out. In federal law, the written plea agreement is in effect just a guide for the judge to follow. In federal law, a guilty plea can only be entered orally in front of the judge in a felony case. So what you might have signed in advance, you sign the plea agreement, you sign the statement of facts.
Right.
Until you go before a judge and go over all of the issues orally, answering the judge's questions under oath, you don't have a guilty plea. So the problem that creates for a defendant is that it becomes extremely difficult to back out of a guilty plea because you have raised your hand under oath and told the judge the following things are true. And at the end of that entire process, the judge says, okay, how do you now plead to count three of the indictment charging you with guilty or not guilty? When you say guilty, you know, that the cake is baked.
Right.
You know, it's very difficult to back up from there, even if the facts is reflected in some of the discovery might be different in the days ahead. The opinion, the view of the court is, that's not a question. Maybe the nature of the government's evidence against you might have changed, but you stood up in court in front of me and raised your hand and swore to tell the truth. And as part of that, you said you were guilty. Regardless what the evidence was, you said you did X, Y, Z.
So that's a misconception. I want to go through some of the things that aren't true out there that maybe you can, because you have so many years experience and you've been working on this. Because another thing is, so there was a whole stupid controversy. There's so much infighting on all sides right now. The entire internet is like very hard. I feel like it's like some kind of mind control operation and people are just being spewed with so much information. You really have to be very discerning, which is not that easy if you don't have the kind of time that is necessary. But so there is something in front of the Supreme Court right now. I think it's in Fisher's case. It's a 1512, I think. Can you explain what that is exactly and what is going on and why and how it could change the trajectory of some of these cases?
Well, it's a huge issue. It's a question over the application of an obstruction of justice statute, section 1512C2. The Supreme Court has agreed in the case of United States versus Joseph Fisher to review his conviction and to look at not only how the issue regarding 1512 was resolved in the district court. In fact, in Fisher's case, Judge Nichols dismissed the count on the basis that it did not apply to the facts as alleged by the government. The appellate court reversed Judge Nichols and sent it back, saying in their view, it does apply. But that was a 2-1 decision, and the two judges that sent it back didn't agree on what. So you have three opinions written in that case. You have two opinions in the majority where the two judges come to the same outcome, but they come to that outcome for different reasons.
Oh, okay.
And then you have the third judge who disagrees with them and agrees with Judge Nichols below that the count doesn't apply. So you have, in effect, this mess. Now, 15, or I think all but one of the district court judges, and I can't remember now if it's 13 out of 14 or 14 out of 15 or 15 out of 16, the number keeps changing, but all but one of the district court judges, Judge Nichols being the only holdout, has previously held that the statute, section 1512C2, does apply to the events at the Capitol. Now, what the defense, and we've been making these motions for 2+ years. This is not something new. It's been filed in cases going all the way back to the fall of 2021. And the judges consistently ruled against the defense until Judge Nichols.
Okay.
But the argument is that this obstruction of justice statute targets the impairment of the availability of evidence before a tribunal.
Oh, wow.
In other words, you have 1512C1 and 1512C2. C1 specifically talks about the mutilation, destruction, blah, 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 of evidence or the intimidation of witnesses, something that prevents material coming before a court or other tribunal. C2 says, or otherwise corruptly interferes with an official proceeding.
Right.
So the question is, does the phrase or otherwise only apply to other forms of evidence impairment?
Right.
You know, just, you know, other verbs that might describe evidence impairment or adjectives. My English is terrible. One of those two grammatical terms apply.
It could be either.
or does otherwise throw open the gates to any form of conduct that in any way interferes with an official proceeding? The term official proceeding is later defined to include proceedings before Congress. So that's how you end up with a congressional map. Okay. But the real question is, when Congress wrote this statute, did it, because if or otherwise means anything, then why do you have A1 or right. C1? Why do you right. have C1 that specifically describes evidence impairment?
Right.
If C2 would include all of that and everything else. So that's the argument, is that the expansive definition of C2 used by the court essentially makes C1 irrelevant. And there's lots of Supreme Court statutory construction cases going back decades or centuries that says, no, all of Congress's words have meaning. Right. You know, if Congress means something different, they'll write something different.
Right. Yep.
Now, the other point I would make, and why this is important to the defense bar, I'm confident at least the last three times, I think it was in the last 20 years, the last three times the Supreme Court has taken up cases where the Department of Justice has used expansive definitions in these kinds of obstruction cases, all three times the court has struck down the Department of Justice's efforts and said, you know, you can't just define these statutory terms so broadly that it just, you know, it reaches the point of absurdity.
Right.
You know, if Congress wants its language to be that broad, it will use broad language.
Right.
You know, because you're talking about, you know, criminal statutes are supposed to provide notice to the public at large. Well, right. If a criminal statute has no boundaries because it's interpreted so broadly by the Justice Department, how does the community have notice that what they are doing is stepping into criminal activity?
Right. You know, so, I mean, that's a bigger picture to what happened that day at all. Most people didn't think that they were committing criminal activity at all that day, not just even people walking in the Capitol that thought that they were allowed. There were many people that had no idea that they were breaking the law at all. And obviously in some of the videos and things, we've seen people cutting down the restricted area, but there are many, many people. And what scared me was Matthew Graves came on and did a press conference on the anniversary of the insurrection. And he said that he's going to be going after, I believe he said another several hundred, maybe thousand people that didn't enter the Capitol that they haven't even contacted yet. Is that what he was saying? I looked at this and I thought, why would you continue down this path? Haven't you done enough? I mean, people that didn't even go in the Capitol now have to be worried that they're going to, you know, cops and FBI are going to show up at their door. I mean, I bet a lot of people were breathing a sigh of relief come, you know, January 6th again, and they were at the Capitol. They didn't go in. And I know a lot of people who were not Trump supporters, including Steve Baker, that were there because they felt there's problems with our election. So what is this new round he's announcing?
Well, and this is consistent with what I have heard for several months. You know, the initial, what I will call, the low-hanging fruit for the prosecutorial effort was the cases that had the clearest and easiest to obtain and use evidence. And in some respects, the most serious offenses, you know, the actual episodes of violence between protesters and police, where you have police, you know, wearing body-worn cameras where you can see the person right in front of the officer and you can see exactly what they do or don't do.
Right.
That, you know, those were, you know, once you had the identities of the individuals involved, that becomes a relatively straightforward case to prosecute. You had, you know, low-hanging fruit, so to speak, would have been, you know, people captured on the CCTV videos inside the building.
Right.
You know, once you have the identity, that's a relatively straightforward case to prosecute. And so there were plenty of those, you know, 1,200 plus such cases that have been pursued to date. You know, at about 800 or 900, the government paused. There was several months. I kind of go back to February or March of this of 2023 up through about September, where there seemed to be a perceptible slowing in the pace of charging and arresting decisions. And I had guessed at the time, and this was later confirmed to me sort of in an indirect way, I guessed at the time that what had happened was that the court had just become saturated. Okay. It had all the cases it could manage. You know, it's not like they hired new judges and new courtroom staff for this big, huge influx of cases the Department of Justice pursued starting in, you know, March of 2021. And so at some point, you know, after a year or a year and a half, the court communicated to the Justice Department, you have to stop until some of these cases get resolved. Okay. Because remember, the government struggled to produce discovery for the first 10 or 11 months, and no cases went to trial. No cases got resolved. There were no plea agreements, you know, until late in 2021 and then into 2022. So, you know, you just had a system that became overburdened by the number of cases.
Right.
And so the government paused. And I think, you know, there was a period of 6, 7, 8, 9 months where they didn't do much. But now, starting in September of 2023, I noticed a dramatic increase in the pace of new charges, new filings. You know, it seems like it's been consistently 6, 7, 8 people a week. Wow. Since then. Now, so that's over, you know, 14, 16 weeks, a couple of hundred people easily. And now I think what Graves was saying is, okay, it becomes more difficult for us to charge people who are just outside because we don't have CCTV. You know, if you went outside, you're not on any of the, you know, closed circuit television cameras inside the Capitol building.
Right.
If you didn't, you know, if you weren't engaged in an actual confrontation with a police officer, it's unlikely that they have body-worn camera video of that. But there, you know, thousands of people had their cell phones out recording events. And thousands of people posted those videos on YouTube or Facebook or Rumble or other locations.
Right.
So all of that material is available. And as the government now kind of turns to that third group of defendants, the people that stayed outside, I think where they can positively identify people from video, they're probably going to move forward and charge them. Now, those charges have, in the last couple of months, become much more difficult. There have now been 4 judges, including Judge Cooper in a case I handled, he just ruled last Friday,
okay,
who have looked at this particular statute. It's the call, we call it the 1752 count, presence on restricted grounds, and said, the language of this statute seems to require that the government prove the defendant knew the grounds were restricted. Now, how do you, now, why are the, this is the interesting twist here. Why were the grounds restricted? Well, under the statute in question, restricted grounds are grounds that are under the control of the Secret Service.
Wow.
And the Capitol is only under the control of the Secret Service when a Secret Service protectee is present. That is the president, vice president, or family members. So the Capitol building only became restricted when Vice President Pence was there.
Right.
The government now has to prove, according to these 4 judges, which wow, sort of cut across the political spectrum, you know, yep, they're not, you know, it's not just the Trump appointees. They cut across, Judge Cooper ruled this way last Friday, and I believe he was an Obama appointee. The judges are ruling that the government has to prove that the defendant knew Vice President Pence was in the building.
Right, and he wasn't there a lot. They say he wasn't there the whole time, too. So they're going to have to also get the exact time that the person was there. Wow, that's pretty crazy.
And this creates quite an evidentiary hurdle for the government. They're going to have difficulty. They're going to struggle to prove actual knowledge by defendants of the vice president's presence.
Exactly. And
where they can't prove it, and in fact, the case where Judge Cooper acquitted Jeremy Grossclose on 2 counts under that statute, he said the government did not prove that Mr. Grossclose knew the vice president was present.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a lot of people. I honestly think a lot of people didn't know any of this, and a lot of people were caught up in that day. And I agree with you and everyone else. If there was real violence, that's it. That's a big deal. And it shouldn't be like, oh, those people are excused because of the what the day was. Now, but the one thing that has never happened is nobody, including Donald Trump, has been charged with insurrection. And yet we have It seems like it was a to me, this is my opinion, but it seems like there was a pre-determined idea that this was, everyone was on the same page, because it was Mitch McConnell, you know, Pelosi, Schumer, everyone, AOC, everyone that went out and spoke that day was saying insurrection, insurrection. It was very important for them to say insurrection. Then all the media at the same time, insurrection. When insurrection doesn't really fit the bill here, I don't see how it does. But what is the importance, A, of them using insurrection if there is an importance, and B, nobody, I believe, has been charged with this.
Juvederm is a luxurious, toxin-free skincare that actually works. Not only do we take the toxins out, we put the most powerful nutrients in. All of our products are an effective way to detoxify, replenish, and protect your skin. Our toxin-free, natural ingredients provide real results without compromising your skin's health. Unlock the secret to beautiful, healthy skin using this synergistic skincare system. It's never too late or too early to begin living a more beautiful life with Juvederm. Natural, healthy skin.
Head over to the MelKayShow.com partners page and get a 10% discount now.
Correct. And I think that's part of the problem here. Is that, you know, some words are scary sounding, but they have specific legal meanings. And, you know, politicians throw around the terms because they sound scary without really understanding that the facts don't specifically fit the legal description of the term. An insurrection is exactly that kind of word. It's a scare word, but the events of January 6th don't really fit the facts. That's why the Justice Department has never charged anyone. And that's why Jack Smith has not made an attempt to charge former President Trump. Because it under the legal standard, it can't be proved. But that doesn't stop anybody from tossing it around, including apparently, I didn't hear the whole speech, but my understanding is that Joe Biden used that word 15 times in his speech on January 6th.
Yes, he did. And it's important that people realize that not only did an insurrection not happen, but the definition of an insurrection did not happen. And yes, he did say that. And also, you know, Joe Biden in his speech continued to say that 5 police officers died. There was a violent insurrection, and that there wasn't that they were trying to stop a peace transfer of power. But Donald Trump didn't try to stop the transfer of power, from what I saw, at all. I mean, regardless of January 6th, they're still saying those talking points. So this peaceful transfer of power. So a lot of these people that I'm talking about, and the news people, but McConnell, all the same people, they say insurrection. And they also always say to stop the peaceful transfer of power. I don't think that happened either, did it?
Well, okay. So to interfere with peaceful transfer of power is a term of art that's contained in the seditious conspiracy statute.
Oh, wow.
Well, actually, I take that back. It's not. It doesn't even talk about the transfer of power. It just talks about interference with the execution of a law.
Right. Okay.
And the government in the Oath Keeper and Proud Boys case has said that the interference with the execution of law in this instance was the transfer of power by Congress. Now, that's not necessarily what happens on January 6th. That's not really an accurate description. I mean, the transfer of power happens at noon on January 20th.
Right.
When one president's term ends and another president's term begins, that's the transfer of power. These are exactly what you said. These are talking points. This is the narrative, not the facts. This is the narrative. And I think what the Department of Justice is intending to do is to continue to charge people over the next year or 11 months through the November election, because they want a continual parade of arrests, searches, indictments, guilty pleas, trials, sentencings. They want that process to continue rolling right along, right up through Election Day, because what they are doing is creating the impression in the mind of the wider electorate that this, you know, this part of Donald Trump's supporters are is a criminal element.
Right. Right. Yeah. And no matter what, there are millions. This is why I think your Twitter handle, and if people aren't following it, we'll put it below, is really important, because what you tend to do, I think, is when there's so much rhetoric out there and it's coming from all sides, you tend to, like, because you've been on so many of these cases, you know all the terminology. And that's where a lot of this, you know, this confusion about what actually happened that day, is a lot of it is in the terminology. Another part of what's happening here is now we have the Supreme Court today is looking at Trump's immunity. And like you just mentioned, Trump was still president until January 20th. I mean, whether they like it or not, he was. So this whole immunity thing, whether he had immunity or not, listen, I think the whole world, because I read a lot of world news, the whole world is watching the Trump cases, okay? And when you read newspapers from, you know, I have a friend that comes on from Monaco or from Yugoslavia, from even Switzerland. I have a friend journalist there, or somebody from Egypt, and they're watching what's happening to Donald Trump. Most people can't believe what's going on in our system when it's coming to the Trump cases, especially the Jack Smith case, because the judge, both cases in New York, but the judge in the and New York cases aside, they're totally nuts. But the Jack Smith case has been, people don't understand what's going on. I see a lot of people deciphering it differently. So right now it appears that the Supreme Court is determining his immunity status, and Jack Smith is on hold, and Chuck and their case is on hold until that. But Jack Smith keeps filing stuff as if it's not on hold. And there's so much confusion about what's going on. So I want you to kind of to tell us where that case is and what is actually going on with that, and what the Supreme Court is actually deciding about immunity. Is it his whole presidency? Is it that period of time? So if you could dispel that, because I see there, all over the world, people are reporting this in totally different ways.
Okay, it hasn't reached the Supreme Court yet. There was an oral argument this morning in the Circuit Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, so one step below the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Three-judge panel this morning listened to the arguments of the two sides based upon, you know, briefs that have been filed over the last 3 weeks. The issue is whether or not a president, while in office, enjoys some level of immunity from later criminal prosecution after he leaves office. Now, it's a question that's never been addressed by the appeals court, never been addressed by the Supreme Court, because no former president has ever faced what Donald Trump is facing.
Crazy.
So there is no right answer to that question yet. You know, there's a lot of a lot of pontificating online that says, well, you know, they'll never grant this. This is just a ridiculous effort. He's just a private citizen now, like anybody else. No man is above the law.
I know it.
Right? That's
right?
What no man is above the law. It's like, well, hold on. You know, in 1982, the Supreme Court decided a case called Nixon versus Fitzgerald. And in that case, a former federal employee was attempting to sue Richard Nixon and some other officials because he believed that conduct by Richard Nixon had cost him his job, and he lost a bunch of money as a result. Now, I'm oversimplifying the facts, but he was a government contractor.
Yeah.
And the case was in the district court here in the District of Columbia. And the appeals court, you know, the Richard Nixon made an argument based on immunity, saying that while he was president,
he
was immune from any suit for civil damages for decisions he made as president. The only difference between the case now and that case was one was for civil damages, and this case is for criminal responsibility, the pending case. And there was no decision that had ever been made that said a president was immune from civil damages. And so, you know, Fitzgerald was pressing his case, and the district court said, well, I guess we'll have to have a trial and decide and see what happens. And the Supreme Court took it up and said, well, no, in fact, even though the Constitution does not anywhere reference whether or not the president is immune, we're going to find that there is a level of presidential immunity that flows from the common law, meaning it's not constitutional law.
Oh,
it goes back to It goes back to English common law that is carried forward into U.S. law unless Congress sets it aside.
Wow.
And so There was no civil immunity for a president until the Supreme Court said there was. And in fact, the Supreme Court said, yes, within the outer boundaries of presidential authority, a president cannot be sued for damages based upon his decision making. And the reason for that is obvious if you think about it.
It is.
The reason for it is you don't want a president while in office dealing with difficult issues, making decisions while in the back of his mind thinking, am I going to get sued for this when I leave office? You don't want that kind of influence in the decision making. You want his decision making to be based just upon what's the best decision.
Yeah.
So then the question, so that rationale, though, is probably more compelling in the criminal context.
Right.
In other words, while a president is in office, facing a difficult decision, do you want him to think, okay, I need to be careful what I decide here because some prosecutor in Atlanta might choose to indict me in 4 years?
But much less
a special prosecutor like Jack Smith.
Yeah.
So those are the competing issues. And just like there was never any civil immunity until Nixon versus Fitzgerald, there's not any criminal immunity now until the Supreme Court says there is. And they might very well say there is.
That's very dangerous, though, because I'll tell you what, just from being, I left Manhattan, but I lived there. And when they changed a lot of the rules for the NYPD, and I have friends that are NYPD, these guys became, you know, when they initially would have arrested somebody or gone after somebody or whatever, now they can't, or they're scared to. So that has a lot to do with just of cops around the country.
Let's talk about Donald Trump. They changed the statute of limitations for sexual assault in New York so that that woman, Jean Carroll, could sue Donald Trump. The statute had expired. It had lapsed, and they extended it just so that she would be able to bring her suit against him.
I know. And Letitia James' suit, even worse, because I'll tell you, as a New Yorker, Donald Trump did more for New York City, not just the skyline, but a lot of other things people don't even know about. To kick him out of New York City, not allow him to be in real estate, $300 million when all these people were coming on the stand that gave him loans, being like, no, it was great. They gave him, what is going on in the Southern District of New York? And then that adds to the Epstein case and a billion other things we could talk about. But there's one more. So just to clarify the immunity thing. So if they do say that he doesn't have immunity, that could also, see, if I'm Obama or George Bush, George W. Bush or Biden, and that happens, that would also mean that they don't either. So to me, and future presidents, like you're saying, like I know my NYPD friends are like, well, they really think twice before they go to a scene in the Bronx where, you know, they know that they're going to be under attack. They don't want to get sued for doing their job. But all these presidents then would be open to lawsuits. I mean, there were drone strikes by Obama that people could turn around and say, well, you killed my family member. I'm going to sue you now. I mean, can't they do that? Isn't that too dangerous?
Well, they couldn't sue him because, remember, you know, his president has immunity from civil damages. But, you know, it's a violation of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution to deprive somebody of life without due process of law.
Right.
And so that's potentially a criminal violation. No, I mean, these are sort of esoteric, you know, crazy hypotheticals. But, you know, it was a crazy hypothetical that some prosecutor would prosecute Donald Trump for giving a speech, you know, where his political opponents say he didn't say enough to prevent or halt the violence. You know, the motivation, it ramps up, you know. So the problem here is that it's entirely likely that even if Donald Trump was convicted in the district court, he would be exonerated on appeal. You know, the conviction would be a reverse and thrown out, but it's too late at that point. The damage is done. All the Democrats are trying to accomplish here is to get him convicted.
Right.
They do not care if the conviction is legitimate or holds up on appeal. By that point, it doesn't matter to them. Their only goal is to prevent his re-election in November 2024. That's it. If they accomplish that goal, they don't care if he spends a day in jail.
I know. I know, and it's so sad for our country. It's really, really embarrassing on many levels overseas and here. Last thing I want to talk about is you have a bunch of cases coming up, and this is costing you a fortune, and you have done so much for these people. And I want to talk a little bit about how people are affording this that come to you. Because a lot of these people, they, first of all, by now, just being charged, this costs a fortune. So there's the whole issue here of lawfare in my mind. You know, a lot of these people were just, you know, normal people with families and jobs. They came up, they felt patriotic duty and came. But I don't see how these people are paying for this. I don't know how you're getting paid. But I think the American people have to understand part of all of this legal stuff coming from the government is the government has unlimited funds, and human beings, American citizens, do not have unlimited funds. They're not getting financial help for this. You're not getting financial help for this because you're a private attorney. So how much is this costing the average person that is charged? It's got to be a fortune. I don't know how anyone could possibly pay for this if they don't come into it with money.
Well, there, I mean, there's two angles to that. Is it actually costing them a lot of money? Well, yeah, because, you know, a certain group, and I don't mean to define the specific individuals, but the certain group of lawyers come into these cases and say, oh, this is going to cost $75,000. This can cost $100,000. Those are ridiculous numbers. Cases
okay,
are not that
good, because I know some people, some defendants that had.
Well,
that
that's what they're being told.
Yeah, I know.
And that's what they're paying. And that's what they're paying. And they're just getting ripped off, because I can guarantee you, unless the lawyer is a complete idiot who spends all his time doing unproductive nonsense, you can't spend $100,000 of time doing these cases unless you're charging somebody $1,000 an hour.
Right. And a lot of those lawyers.
There's not that much work.
Yeah, a lot of those lawyers you're talking about were referred to other people. And a lot of people, I think, took plea deals because of those numbers, honestly.
Right. So that's a ridiculous number. I mean, I have done 40 cases basically raising $400,000, $10,000 a case.
But you need it.
Okay.
I mean,
and that includes expensive. and that includes six cases that went to trial, two cases of which were back to back for 15 weeks. I was in this city for 15 weeks sitting in courtrooms.
Wow.
And you know, I mean, if I was to try a case and it was just like, let's say it's a non-January 6th white collar crime with some level of sophistication, and I really had to prepare for it and then be involved, you know, every day for trial, you know, what I generally, I charge a client a few $1,000s a day. And that's because it's essentially 10 days times whatever that hour or 10 hours times whatever that hourly rate is per day. Because when I'm in trial, I can't do anything else. That's all I can do.
Yeah.
So everything else gets set aside. You know, you have to work on it on weekends or whatever to keep the other balls in the air. So that's the basic trial fee.
Right.
These cases are, for the most part, 2, 3, 4 days long.
Right.
And I mean, unless you're charging your client $10,000 a day, these are not $75,000 cases. You know, you have few hours of video to look at.
Right.
You have so that's why a lot of people are being stampeded into plea agreements, because they don't think they can afford a defense because the lawyers are charging them ridiculous amounts of money. Alternatively, you know, if for defendants who cannot afford to pay, they get appointed lawyers. There are the most of the appointed counsel in the District of Columbia are just like all other lawyers in the District of Columbia. They're almost exclusively liberal.
Right.
So you've got these, you know, Donald Trump supporters being represented by lawyers who have completely opposite political views.
Right.
And they don't have any confidence in their lawyers. Their lawyers are telling them, oh, you're guilty. You should plead guilty.
Right.
What I have done, going back to almost the very beginning, is I've tried to focus my efforts on people that reach out to me and say, you know, I don't have a lot of money. I've got an appointed lawyer. You know, the lawyer's telling me I should just plead guilty. I don't think I should. I don't have any confidence. I haven't seen my discovery. My lawyer doesn't spend any time talking to me. They just want my case to be over with. I don't know what to do. Okay. So in that circumstance, you know, I come at this, I don't explain this as well, but I come at this because when I got started doing it, I had this view based on my own experience when I was a prosecutor.
Right.
And I was a federal prosecutor for 21 years.
I know.
When I was a prosecutor, a lot of former prosecutors were defense lawyers because we understand the system. We understand the process.
Yep.
And it makes it provides for better representation for defendants. I have never handled in 34 years, I have never handled a state criminal case. I have only handled federal criminal cases. And so this is all, you know, I know this stuff like the back of my hand.
Right.
I've done it so exactly. many hundreds, if not thousands of times.
Right.
So when I came into it, I expected to find other former prosecutors defending these cases, either appointed or, you know, on, you know, whatever fee arrangements of the clients could. And they're just, with the exception of five or six people, there aren't any. They aren't doing it.
Why?
And some of it is,
why? Well, why do you think? Even people on our side, it's the lawyer shortage in a world full of way too many lawyers in this case and many of the other. Is it just that they don't want their, I guess if you get involved like you, I mean, you've sacrificed a lot and you've been attacked a lot. And is it because of that, that most people just don't want, you know, it's not worth the trouble?
There's two parts to it. One is most federal prosecutors, and when I say most, I mean the vast majority, probably 80% or more. You know, when they leave federal service, when they leave the government, I mean, it's a very impressive resume entry.
Yes.
And they go to big law firms.
Right.
And they represent big, you know, corporate clients. And those law firms almost exclusively, almost down to the last one, said, we're not going to represent J6 defendants because it's going to upset our corporate clients. We do not want to be a law firm that represents J6 defendants.
Yeah.
So that keeps most of them out.
Okay.
Some might be willing to do it, but their law firms tell them, nope, if you want to do it, you got to quit. And right. they're not willing to do that. Right. Now that's not, I mean, I've got three or four, maybe five former AUSAs that I know in big law firms that have done a handful of cases. They're not in it like I am.
Right.
But see, when I left, I knew I didn't want to go to big law when I left, you know, the federal government. When I went out on, I went out on my own.
Right.
I get it.
People that work at the firms but you know what's sad is that some of those firms have take on pro bono clients, but they won't do it for this. They just don't want this in their world.
A lot of them are representing Gitmo detainees. They represent terrorists sitting over Gitmo. They litigated getting Gitmo detainees freed rather than, you know, because there were, you know, problems with having trials. So
right.
Yeah, it's head scratching.
Yeah. But you've done it, and you've done it. You know, I also think you've done a lot to educate people on the actual law. And that is why I am really grateful when you come on, because a lot of the things that you talked about today, people need to understand the facts, because once, you know, you start down that road, then there's all this rhetoric and people can't, you know, they have false expectations, or they think, you know, a lot of people think today the Supreme Court is looking at Trump's case, and that's not what's going on today. And again, I'm just really grateful to you for your work. I think you've been very helpful in this whole thing. And I'm glad you're representing Steve Baker, because I like him a lot. And I really,
I'm not alone. I'm not alone in that regard. There's four lawyers, myself and three others, who have all signed on to help Steve. We've known him going back to the Oath Keeper case, where he covered the Oath Keeper case every day in the courtroom. He was there reporting on the entire case, not just the government's evidence.
Now, he's been very fair too. He's called. I follow his work, and he's a libertarian. He's not a Trump person. He's not a Democrat. He's kind of trying to go at it as unbiased as you can. So I am praying for him and for you. Now, can you tell my audience, we do need money, folks. These people, now we're talking about, we don't know how many more are going to be charged and going under. And what Bill has done is honestly put his life on hold. He doesn't live in D.C. either. So that's a big deal to travel. So how can people help you? There's been a lot of confusion. So I want people to know exactly where to go to donate to you and your clients. I'm sure you're going to have more upcoming as well. I think it's really important that American people take this personally, because right now what we're watching is pretty scary, but it just, they keep arresting more and more people for different things. And you have to remember, if it's if you don't stand up for people now and it happens to you, you're going to, you know, regret that. So can you tell people how to support you and how to support these people?
Well, okay, let me say that anybody who wants to make any donations online should really take a little bit of time and research who they're giving to.
Right.
And ask for transparency. Where is that money actually going?
Right.
You know, there are efforts online to, I think, take advantage of sympathetic donors. There are efforts online to misdirect donations. I had a GiveSyngo account. Did not have my name on it. It was just called the January 6th Legal Defense Fund.
Right.
Okay. That fund, that GiveSyngo account was copied. And somebody else set up a very similar standing account. Let me back this up. That's not technically factually. What happened is I had a website.
Right.
And the website was called the January 6th Legal Defense Fund. And the website accepted donations via PayPal. And there was some reluctance in the broader community to contribute through PayPal. A lot of people didn't want to, I can't remember who it's connected to, Google or whoever.
Yeah.
And unknown to me, a GiveSyngo site was set up that looked almost identical to my website. And that GiveSyngo site then began to solicit donations. And I know I've heard over and over and over again that people give to that GiveSyngo site thinking the money is going to my clients, and it does not. So I set up a GiveSyngo site in response to that, saying, well, you know, I've got to, you know, have something there so that people on GiveSyngo that want to contribute know it's going to the right place.
Exactly.
Okay, so that has gone on with some amount of controversy now for 16 months. Well, finally, I closed out my original GiveSyngo site. I now have a new GiveSyngo site that has my name on it, where it has Shipwrecked Crew on it.
Great.
So there can't be any confusion. If you're looking to donate to my clients, it's in a new GiveSyngo account that has Shipwrecked Crew in the title. I think it's called Shipwrecked Crew January 6th Legal Defense Fund.
Great.
So that's what you need to look for.
Okay.
You know, there are lots of people soliciting money that, in my view, and it's just my opinion, they have just turned it into an employment opportunity. Well, you can say that about me too. You could say this is an employment opportunity.
No, I'm not going to let you do
that. But I'm going to court. I'm going to court.
You're not just going to court.
You were working.
You were a prosecutor on the other side for 21 years. You did not have to do this. And I'm going to end on that, because you are putting so much time, effort, and energy, not just in court, but also in correcting the record and talking about legal issues and informing people and educating people. And I want to end on, why are you doing this?
Well, you know, a very short story is, when I got into it, I did not expect to have to raise money. The arrangement that I first got into it with involved another party who was confident they could raise money. And I was confident they could raise money too. And for the first 90 days, that worked. This would be October, November, December of 2021. That worked. But then it blew up. And I'm not going to go into the details or why, but it blew up. And and that individual and I had to separate and go our separate ways. Agreeably, we both talked about it. We said, yeah, that's what we're going to have to do. And then I was in the position where I was already in 18 cases. And my two choices were withdraw, because I wasn't going to have my work funded the way I had thought.
Right.
So my choices were withdraw and let those people go back to having appointed lawyers, or stay in the cases and figure out another way to pay for it. Well, we set up a website, and then later we set up a GiveSyngo site. I cannot begin to describe the level of shock that I have experienced actually seeing the generosity of people in the public to generate, to donate towards my clients' costs. And so far, we've made it work.
I want to talk about you. You personally have sacrificed a lot. Okay. And not just in your reputation, financially, you don't live in DC. In your heart of hearts, this is what I want people to understand. You don't have to do this. You're doing this because you feel compelled to do it. Why is that?
Well, because as a former prosecutor, I can do this in greater numbers than pretty much anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that there's another lawyer that I've met doing these cases that has the capacity to do them in the volume that I can do them, because none of this is new to me. Right. None of this is difficult. I do not have to sit and research for hours because most of the procedural issues I already know. And the only other reason I'm able to do this, and I do not ever really talk about this. The only other reason that I'm able to do this is that I have a very forgiving family. I have four children still under 16. I have one that's older. I have one off in college, but I have four 16 or younger, and they've been back here a couple of times to sort of see what's going on. And my wife, and they're okay with it.
I know, but that's the beauty part is you are doing this, A, because you believe it's the right thing to do, and B, you have a family that supports you and you are still supporting that family. So on top of all of this, you know, what you've done here is truly remarkable. And I know you're not even close to done, and then God knows how many of the new cases will come. But to me, you're a hero, and I really, really appreciate you being here. And again, tell people the give, send, go. This has been a whole debacle, but I wanted to have Bill back on because it's really important that we continue helping his clients through him, because he's really doing a phenomenal job. And this is and he has a whole life that he put on hold for this. And it's really important to, when people do that, really support them. So one more time, where they can find you and then where they can follow you. I highly recommend you follow him on Twitter to get some real news about what is going on in the courts, not just about this. He covers what's going on in the Trump trials and other things too as well. So tell them again the give, send, go, and then how they can follow you personally.
Okay, the give, send, go again. If you just, you know, search for Shipwrecked Crew Give, Send, Go, you should come up with a link to my give, send,
we'll
go
have
page, and it has my name on it. So look for Shipwrecked Crew. I'm also on Twitter under the same handle, Shipwrecked Crew. This right. I could never even get away from that now if I wanted to. And finally, we haven't mentioned this, but I write a Substack page under Shipwrecked Crew.
Cool.
I actually started doing that back in 2021, and I stopped for a period of time. And then this past March, I started it again. So I've been doing it about 10 months, and all the proceeds, I mean, I like to write. I like to write about politics. I like to write about the law. Right. All of the proceeds from it's a subscription Substack. You have to pay to read all the articles.
Got it.
But the proceeds all are donated or contribute to my ability to do these cases.
Oh, great. So that's another place, and you'll get information and really thorough assessments of what's going on in the legal system and otherwise, because he's a very good analyst of what is really happening. Thank you so much, Bill. I am so grateful.
One more thing I want to mention. I'm back writing for Red State. I wrote for Red State for about 16 months, ended in the summer of 2021. But about 2 months ago, I started writing much less frequently, only about once a week when I can do it. But I am back up at Red State. If you used to read me there, I'm back there again.
Great, great. And you need to sometimes do other things except for being sitting in court and going through this. So writing is a good way to do a little bit of other stuff. So great. Really appreciate you being here as always. And thank you for all you're doing, not just for all these clients that you have that are fighting January 6th, but for all of us in informing us on what is actually happening and actually how the law works. I appreciate you very much. Thank you. I don't know about you, but I feel a lot better being prepared for whatever's coming. Every day I hear something new. Something's coming from the CDC. Something's coming from the FDA. Who's trying to take over our healthcare system? All this craziness. And what I know is that one man really changed my life, how I look at everything that's happening to me health-wise. And that was Dr. Zelenko. He was a good friend of mine, a good friend of the show. And he came up with the most amazing product. Z-Stack has been a game changer for us. We have not been sick since we've been on it. We take it regularly. We feel like we're coming down with something, we'll double up. But he has all new products over at the website. God rest his soul. He did not leave us unprepared. And that is very important for you to prepare. So he's got Z Shield. He's got a Kid Z Stack, which is awesome. He's got Z Flu, Z Detox. He's got all kinds of things. He always said to me, your immune system must be clean, resilient, and resistant. this matters the most. And what I can say on top of that is that he supported me. He supported free speech. He supported medical freedom. He supported personal liberty and everything that I believe in, he believed in. He inspired me to be myself, to speak up, to speak out. And what matters is that you are feeling healthy, whole, clean, clear, focused, and that your immune system is protected from anything that comes our way. And Z-Stack is the best way to do that. Please stock up on Z-Stack. Go to themelkayshow.com. Go to our partners page. Goes down to Z-Stack. That also supports the show. When you buy from our partners, these great people, especially Dr. Zelenko, who is dear to me, you are supporting the show and keeping us going. And I know that truth, freedom, and the First Amendment matter to you. They matter to him. They matter to me. So make sure you're always healthy. You're always out there. You're always standing up. Be brave. Courage is contagious. The narrative is falling apart, but as it does, there's so much of this fraudulent disinformation, misinformation, censorship coming from the globalists. And what we need to do is be focused on the facts, cut through everything, be discerning, and get it first and foremost out there to everyone. It is important that you know what is going on. Censorship is getting nuts. You guys know it. There's accounts all over the place that are fake, that are not me. I know you guys send me emails and I really appreciate it. And you report it and it's on Telegram and Instagram and Twitter and they're not me. So I'm super excited to announce We the People with Mel K. Be the first to join. It's a VIP community, just you and me behind a paywall, no trolls, no nothing. We get to know each other. I will give you the facts first. I break a lot of stories a long time before other people. We can talk about past, present, future, history, what we're doing now, solutions for going forward, what 2024 is gonna look like. I'm gonna do breaking news, do a lot of deep dives. I'm gonna bring that information to you guys first in a live Q&A every week. So please click the link below and join me over there. We are going to create a community that is censorship proof, it's cancel proof, it's truth, it's transparency, it's on the road to God, country, justice, everything that we want in one place. This is the most incredible, amazing time to be alive. As hard as it seems and as difficult as the battle has been for you guys and definitely for me, all I know is that we all are part of the solution. We are all involved and invested, and you guys have the passion that I have. So let's join together on live Q&As once a week with me, Mel K, we the people of the United States, taking back this nation. This is so exciting, guys. I've been dying to do this, and we finally got the technology right. So please join me. Click the link below. Can't wait to get started.